You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Well, Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show, and I'm Don Olson, and I'm back after a couple weeks off. I had to take care of some things. And Dave Grunick did a great job. He's gone this week, but he'll be back next week. So we're going to start off today. Dave Logsdon has just showed up, and we're going to have a discussion because about the how the U.S. is moving towards automatic registration for a military draft. And Dave and I have spoken about some of these things, and he has a lot of opinions about why a draft would be foolhardy for what's going on, that the U.S. would try and do it. However, you can say that having an automatic registration policy that they have brought about, that they passed, they kind of, according to the New York Times article, they kind of buried it in the National Defense Authorization Act late last year, and that they want to move where all sorts of people would be found out from other databases than what is going on for those who sign up. Right now, in 2024, about 81% of men ages 18 to 25 registered with the Selective Service Program, and replacing its, and so they want to replacing this long-standing model of compiling names with automatic registration instead of people voluntarily signing up, and that this is a process which supposedly is happening after outreach programs telling the public about its obligations, violating and not registering if you're prosecuted could be a maximum of 5 years and or $10,000 fine from 18 to 26, and there are certain things which are withheld from you, like getting a job, a federal job, and sometimes in some places, Tennessee, you can't even go to a state school unless you're registered with a draft. Dave Logsdon, Veterans for Peace, longtime activist on these war peace issues. What's your opinion about what's happening? What's going on here with the U.S. military these days?
Yeah, it's interesting, Don. It's interesting, Don, because first of all, I'm thank you for letting me come on and talk about this issue. And I always say to people, I have to always put a plug in. I said people support KFAI and specifically say support Democracy Now! and Don's show here too. So that's always a good thing. Anyway, to the topic at hand. Yeah, this whole thing about registering people is very, there's something very 1984-ish about that. It's a little bit, having people being denied things and kind of pushing them and nudging them towards the possibility of being drafted. And, you know, honestly, my opinion of the draft, I was drafted in 1966. My academic prowess was severely lacking, and so I got a nice letter from the U.S. government saying that they have other needs for my services. And not being somebody, and I know, Don, you're probably one of those people too, but I know a lot of people in Veterans for Peace here. They volunteer, and they were really into it, and people really, really wanted to be in the military. I never in a thousand years would ever have joined the military, no matter what my situation was. But that's just me. But the fact of the matter is, if you draft somebody, you have somebody who's got a bad attitude on day one, as soon as they come to boot camp. And trust me, the attitude usually goes downhill from there. And that's why you had during the Vietnam War, towards the end of the Vietnam War, they were drafting anybody. There was no felons, anybody. They were drafting people.
They went into Category 4.
Yeah, Category 4. And the Category 4 people had no problem throwing a fragging officers and things like that. And you talk to any career military person, and they say the last thing they want is to have an army of draftees, because it's usually a lot of attitude there, and they use most of it bad, you know. So I do think... second of all, the possibility of a draft, politically, there's not too many politicians that are going to vote for a draft, no matter what the situation is, because, frankly, you look at the American people right now, even people that are not even engaged in the political discussion are like, this is a bad idea, this whole war in Iran. And for us to draft people into a situation where if you're on a ship, you're a sitting duck, or you're in a military base in Kuwait or one of these places, you're basically a sitting duck. And if they're thinking about invading, a land invasion, that's even, you talk to anybody with any knowledge of the military, they'll tell you that that's ludicrous. It's a slaughter.
Yes, it's... some roughly 10,000 troops have been taken to the area. They are on these various ships, and that there is the possibility, maybe it's all bluster, maybe it's all, oh, we're going to scare the Iranians.
Yeah.
With all these 10,000 troops we've got, or whatever else, but it's right now it hasn't happened, and they're on these ships.
I think applying logic to whatever this administration goes about doing is really not a good idea, and I think that's why so many of these military guys, who people were naturally I would not agree with on much anything, they're on the outside looking in with this administration, because they're not towing the line and saying, this is a stupid idea. Get rid of this guy. you know, anybody who opposes whatever they're thinking is they're incompetent suddenly, you know.
Well, they have tried to box in the upper military.
No.
I mean, wasn't that an amazing thing when they flew all these top brass Army, Navy, Air Force people to Virginia, and yeah. Hexeth kind of said, this is the way it's going to be. If you don't like it, get out.
Yeah, that's... I'm just a... It is pretty amazing, this whole emasculating of the military, which, honestly, as somebody who's wanted to emasculate the military for many years, it's kind of a strange situation to be in, to look at these generals being dressed down, you know. But hey, it's a crazy world we live in now, Don.
Well, and they have cashiered people who are the head of the top uniformed general for the Army. He said, you know, he would normally have another year and a half or so to go on his term, and all of a sudden they said, you're done. And they've done it for other people who were going to get some sort of a promotion. And it just so happened that these were two, I believe it was African-American, and two women, two females. And so this was, you know, part of this whole thing about how, which is going on through the rest of the Trump administration, we're going to make it a white nationalist Christian nation, armed forces, and whatever else. That's going to be how it is.
Yeah, and the component of it, the anti-diversity, obvious anti-diversity motivation behind these moves, is interesting, because if they think they want to get people into the military to join the military voluntarily, they're taking away a huge chunk of people that might be predisposed to actually do it by making it very gay and unfriendly for women to join. Women make good soldiers, as they do most anything, and by making it an unfriendly environment, and it is decidedly an unfriendly environment for a woman to join the military. I know there might be somebody out there who's knows a woman who's been in the military and had a wonderful experience, but in my experience, most of the women that go in, especially since post 9/11, there's a large influx of women veterans. They've got post-traumatic stress doubled down, because they got the post-traumatic stress of being in combat and the post-traumatic stress of being a woman in the military.
Which has often led to rape.
Yeah.
Which is kind of hard.
Yeah.
Especially if it's somebody up your chain of command.
Absolutely. I know from being in the military that your options are pretty slim if you want to take an officer down or testify against an officer. Because even if you win, you lose. Because if you win and the officer is reprimanded, well, guess what? You get reassigned to something else, and you get a big little check mark by your name saying, here, she's a problem, kind of thing. And therefore, you end up, if you're a woman who wanted to make a career out of the military, you're sadly glass ceilinged very quickly.
And all sorts of more behind the scenes remarks and on your record, everything starts to go badly for you, and especially if you have some career aspirations of going 20 years and getting a
bringing it back to the draft. I'm thinking, if I was drafted, if I was a 19-year-old person and human being, I was a male, and I got drafted, and the sister doesn't get drafted, I'm filing a discrimination lawsuit a class action discrimination lawsuit, because if it is a draft, they would have to draft men and women, because there's no way you could just say, oh, we're just going to draft men, because women do serve in combat. They can't say, well, women don't serve in combat, that's why we're not drafting them. That's not true. That's a false statement. So I think that's why I don't think, if you have a draft and little Johnny and Joni out in Minnetonka are getting their draft notice, this war or any kind of ramp up to war is going to end up very quickly and done.
It's always a situation with women that the National Organization of Women has said, well, if there's going to be a draft, there's got to be women involved with it also, because if women are not part of any of the organizations that run society, women will then be still second-class citizens. So you have a lot of women who really push for that also. And it's, you know, it's from, there was a time, of course, when there was, as late as into the 60s, when the Southern members of Congress would say, well, the flower of American womanhood should not be consumed or corrupted by being in the military.
Nobody should be corrupted by being in the military. And if you've seen this recent movie by Abby Martin about the Earth's greatest enemy, if you're joined the Marines and you're assigned to Camp Lejeune, I have one word of advice: don't drink the water.
Isn't that just like, my gosh? I mean, how basic is water? I mean, like, these are Marines are exercising all day long, maneuvers, just tramping around. And then, lo and behold, oh, yeah. What's this? The water ain't so good, is it?
Yeah, you have to remember, John, that the term GI stands for government issue. And once you're in the military, you sign that contract, you are a commodity. A person signing a military contract immediately becomes a second-class citizen, because you are at the behest of the U.S. government. And if you want to say, you know what, I want to quit this job, well, good luck. You're assigned. And I think you look at the way soldiers are treated. Now, while they're in the military, often pawns in a game decided by generals, when they get out, the VA, they go to the VA to get their some support. And all across the board, they started actually even in Biden's administration, but it's doubled down now with Trump, is that the VA is being cut. And here you are, they want to spend $300 million to build this little ballroom at the White House. And then they say, when the veterans need help, it's like, oh, we got some spare change for you. We'll help you out here a little bit. I mean, it's a national disgrace, Don, that the veterans are not taken care of when they come back. Whether you agree with the war, you agree with the reasons for people joining the military, when they come back, you have an obligation as a country to take care of those veterans. And the VA will take care of it. They have really good people at the VA. And it's also a teaching hospital. So it's really a wonderful experience at the VA if they have enough staff. And the main problem is that they get cut. So one person is doing the job of two people or three people. And therefore, the amount of care gets watered down. So, to me, it's a disgrace, and anybody out there would like to call or write to your congressperson and say, we need to fully fund and fully employ people at the VA.
And here, you know, I get all these letters contributing money for wounded veterans. Well, my goodness, if the government isn't going to be paying enough to take care of people who have been in the military and who have some sort of a malady, mental or physical, and if they're not getting that, and they have to go, you know, drum beating around.
And you think about the most of these, and I'm not going to call out any specific veterans nonprofit, but there are a number of veterans nonprofit that play on the fact people's emotions. They want to help out veterans, which is a good, you know, well-meaning. They give money to these groups, and if you look at the there's a site called the Charity Watchdog thing. It's a, you know, and they grade out all the different charities, and by and large, most of the veterans groups grade out very poorly on the grade scale. They had my kind of grades. They were D's and F's. And so just because it says veterans, just don't automatically give them money. Do your research on it. There's some really good ones, like the MACVIE, the really good organization working with the veteran homelessness. I really do a really good job. And DAV is another really good one, but a lot of these veterans administrations are very top heavy. A lot of people making money, and what they'll do is they'll help two or three families and bring a camera crew in, and get people say, "Oh, if it wasn't for blah blah blah, I don't know what we could have done," you know, and so they help four people out, and they get a ton of money in. The people at the top get paid, the camera crews get paid, and they help three or four people. So I just say be cautionary. Buyer beware.
Well, just to circle back to the VA, the Veterans Administration, and that there's been local Vets for Peace people and across the country that have been having these support our VA, mm-hmm. and it's you know, it seemed like it would never be happening differently, but then who comes to power? The most self-righteous support of the military, and they're taking away this money from the basic care of veterans.
Yeah, and that's why, Don, that's why I say it's disgraceful, because it really is disgraceful. I mean, I think people who criticize this and say, well, this is a problem, this and that, I think you need to use a little stronger language, and disgraceful is a pretty strong word for it, and it's true.
But it's, you know, I would call it chutzpah, maybe.
Yeah.
For... they talk a talk, and then they take away money, yet even though they're talking about for the next year a 50% increase. Now, this year, huge figure, $1 trillion roughly, $900 billion. It is more than the next 10 militaries combined. And yet, next year, they want to increase it 50% more.
People are bellying up to the trough, and most of these military contractors are salivating, because we're using so much of our stock of ammunition and rockets and stuff that we really have to go into big production now, you know. So I think, in America, we all get swept up in this. You get the flyovers and they ramp up the patriotism to cover up their lack of due diligence in helping out people, helping out especially veterans who supposedly have supported your military adventures and when they come back. And I'm just saying in general, it's we know, I know we're preaching to the choir a lot, but the disparity of income in this country, everything from the cries and hues and cries about Social Security, which could be fixed very easily by just upping the cap on it, so that a billionaire is paying the same percentage into Social Security that I am or you are.
Yeah, because it's the amount of money that is which it is based is.
Yeah, quite, exactly. You know, exactly.
$112,000 a year, or something like that.
If you do that, you say, "Well, it's socialism." It's like, "Well, it's not socialism." Trust me, that's not socialism. But it's just sharing a little bit more of the super rich, and the people who are filthy rich or lighting their big fancy cigars with $100 bills.
Well, of course, we know that a lot of the money in the military budget goes to the military-industrial complex, and the money just goes in, and it's been many, many years before the Defense Department has been able to pass an audit.
Right. They don't have the receipts. And trust me, I worked in small stores on a ship I was on, and I was in charge of selling hats and pea coats and shoes and socks to people, to sailors on the ship. And I was responsible for every pair of socks down to the minute number. I had to have receipts, and everything had to be accountable. And yet, $1 trillion goes out the window, and people say, "I'm not sure. I don't know if we have the receipts on that, but it went somewhere. Somebody got it."
And it's interesting that in this whole debacle, this war of choice going into Iran, we have these missiles, which are pretty hefty price that the Iranians are sending these $50,000, $10,000 drones, and the U.S. and the Israelis are shooting them down, sure, but it's a big difference.
Yeah.
The money being put out.
No, it's very ridiculous. And now the main goal of our war now is open the Straits of Hormuz. Well, breaking news, folks, it was open before we went over there and caused this thing. So it's like if I knock a hole in the side of your car, and then I fix it, and I'm going to look at you and say, "Hey, I fixed your car." And say, "Well, no, you broke the thing, so you should fix it."
So, you know, among other things, why I want to have not have this automatic registration of people is because I want to stop this militarization of youth, that everything is controlled. Everything is going to do that, and
no, it's true, and I think it's part and parcel with this whole
2 o'clock.
The whole military-industrial complex and how you just think about the indoctrinating people in this country, just in general, about our militarization of our country, and of course. I'll make the argument that we've always been a militaristic country from the get-go, right from the beginning.
Well, it was much more it used to be the Department of War. until after World War II became the Defense Department, and Hegseth and crew now want to have it back to the Department of War. Well, as you were saying, the U.S. fought wars continually against...
In that way, I have to say that, at least if you give them some points for honesty, because actually it's always been the Department of War.
Here's another thing, which reason I'm against this automatic registration, you know, because it creates a database, and that can, and that individuals who can be sought by the Department of State and the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services, they can identify non-citizen residents for possible deportation. It's another one where they're squeezing down on society and we're going to be talking about the International Workers Day March tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
And it's... We need immigrants coming in here.
We're a nation of immigrants.
Not only are we a nation of immigrants, but the people who are here are having fewer children, and so there's fewer jobs being filled by people who have always lived here, and it's... And this country has been a place of refuge. We have that Statue of Liberty, and it's horrific violence, which is caused by often U.S. foreign policy. And if not the foreign policy, then multinational corporations who squeeze all the as they can out of these countries, so there's not enough for people to live on, and it creates problems of how to exist, because often these authoritarian governments are supported by the U.S. and people need to flee. And we've had this, and it's now under Trump. They want to get rid of this possibility that people are fleeing as if, oh, well, it can't be all true. Can't be all true. Can't be all true. And but even if it is true, if they're not the right color, I mean, the U.S. actively has been out there seeking white farmers from South Africa to come here. They didn't ask for it, but Trump said, well, he's waving this flag. Hey, come on over here. Come on over here. You're being kicked around. Well, nobody in South Africa is saying...
Send a picture first so we know that you're white before we invite you over here. You know, I mean, that's the reality check. It's the dominant white patriarchy that's been running this this operation in this country for so long. And... the only thing, I always try to look at the bright side of things, Don, like things are darkest before the dawn and phrases like that come up. But the reality is this thing would be rolling along just fine as the same patriarchal driven society. There's somebody like the president, I don't hate to use his word, but his name, but he comes along and he's just upsetting the apple cart. I think it's in some ways it's bringing a lot more people out in the streets here. We saw that with the Metro surge, and We want to see that. We want to see more people becoming involved, becoming citizens. And becoming a citizen means be able to raise your voice and say things. And that's why KFAI is one of those places where the citizens can come here and have their voice heard.
Well, one of the ways that people can be involved in Minneapolis set the mark on the type of opposition to the Operation Metro Surge. I mean, its magazines had it on its cover, and about how resist like Minneapolis. And so that's all good. So here's something tomorrow. Immigrants Rise, Workers Unite, 20th Annual International Workers' Day March. They say 20th annual. It was about 2005 or 6 that there was this A Day Without Immigrants. And there was a huge turnout and stoppage of jobs being fulfilled throughout society, throughout this area at least. So anyway, it's going to be tomorrow, Friday, May 1st, 4:30 p.m. at Lake and Chicago, South Minneapolis. And it's sponsored by MIRAC and
I think the Anti-War Committee?
And the international, well, there's a bunch of groups that are doing that, that are in the IBT, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, are the two that are on this quarter sheet.
I'm a retired Teamster, so those are my peeps, too. So
You drove a truck for quite a while, an IPM, and I don't know who that.
And also, also, if you're, if it's too far for you to travel, if you live in St. Paul, and there is a, at 4 o'clock is the usual Snelling and Summit Solidarity for Palestine rally that happens, and that happens every week. So if you, if Lake in Chicago seems like too far of a trek, you can always go there. And it's May Day on Sunday.
It's Sunday that there is going to be the South Minneapolis going along Bloomington Avenue.
Yeah, 28th and Bloomington, and it's a shorter walk this year. We used to go all the way down to the park and come back, but so this is that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good to have May Day back and strong, and it's one of the most unique parades in the country. It's always been. And I always look at New York's got the Halloween parade, New Orleans at Mardi Gras, and San Francisco Gay Pride, but Minneapolis has had May Day, and May Day has been a unique experience.
Well, I want to thank you, Dave Logsdon, activist for the rights and society of the military, and a longtime member of Veterans for Peace. You're listening to KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. This is the Northern Sun Radio News Show. This is Don Olson. Now I want to play a little bit of a tape I did on Tuesday. It was on the Dialogue Works with Nima Al Korshiel, who was talking with Professor Mohamed Mirandi, who's a geopolitical analyst at the University of Tehran. And he started off by asking about that Trump had announced that he had been talking with Iranians about that Iran is in a state of collapse. And so the questions they were talking about between the two of them, Nima and the professor, was, how did Trump come to this knowledge? And so let's play. This was posted on Tuesday.
Trump is that I assume that he may be hoping that he will outlast the Iranians. But again, it's like the 39-day war. It's like the Ramadan war. The Iranians are fighting for their survival. Trump is fighting a war of choice. Now, whether that war is a violent war or whether it's siege warfare, in either case, the Iranians are going to be very resilient. They are a very resilient people. I think across the world, people have already seen how the Iranians have managed the war beyond anyone's expectations from what we're seeing, from the reactions that we're seeing across the globe. And I think that when it comes to siege warfare, it'll be the same. Of course, it's going to be difficult. And of course, the Iranians are going to have shortages. But what Trump is doing to the entire world is going to be more difficult. It's going to be worse. Because Iran is a country that has lived with sanctions. And as you know, there were years where we exported almost no oil under Trump's own maximum pressure sanctions for, I think, like 3 years or so. I don't know exactly how long, but for maybe up to 3 years, we exported almost no oil. As far as I recall, most of the oil that we exported was like a hundred or so thousand barrels of oil a day to China, and that was... we weren't receiving money for that. That was for something that they'd already done. They completed a project. They carried out a project, and this was what Iran's commitment in return. So for a period of time, the only oil that, or the more or less the only oil that Iran was exporting, was oil that was that Iran was not making any money through. As a result, very little money was made for a period of time. So. That doesn't make things easy. Things will be difficult, regardless of how effective the siege is or the siege is not. That's another point. How many ships actually go through? How successful the Americans are in blocking the siege? That's something that I've seen you've discussed with your other guests. So I won't go down that road. But the fact is that the Iranians, they know that in this waiting game. The American people, American allies, American politicians will be putting pressure on Trump to end this because he is making everyone suffer and no one sees any reason for this suffering except for the fact that Zionists and Netanyahu and Trump have imposed it upon them. Whereas in the case of the Iranian people, they know that this suffering and this difficulty and the shortages will be imposed upon them by an external enemy that has no moral or legitimate reason to carry out this hostility, except for the fact that he is doing it or on behalf of an ethno-supremacist regime that considers itself to be the master race, the chosen people, and therefore it can, you know, impose anything it wants on the rest of the world.
There are some rumors, Professor Morandi, that the United States wants to announce a no-fly zone over Iran, you know, in addition to the blockade happening. Is that going to somehow escalate the situation? Or are we going to see some sort of military confrontations between Iran and the United States?
I don't think it's going to have any impact if such a thing happens, because the Iranian flights are going to continue. And if the United States attempts to target Iranian flights, then that would be war. And then the airspace over the Persian Gulf region, over the countries that are assisting the United States in its war against Iran, such as Qatar, Bahrain, the Emirates, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, they would face a very painful situation. So we'd be going back to war, basically. So if the Americans attempt to do anything over Iranian airspace, it will be difficult. It will be very difficult for them. And Iran's key flights, I would assume, are basically to countries to the east of Iran and to the north of Iran. And so the Americans would have to fly over Iranian airspace to, you know, airports in the north and the east of Iran, and that would be war. That would be, so there would be no more ceasefire. The ceasefire would be open, over. And remember, Nima, you know, we, as I said before, and I don't really want to tire you with repetitive points, which I'm sure I do a lot, but we are entering the hot season, and the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Peninsula becomes very hot and very humid, and it is going to become increasingly difficult for the United States to wage war under these circumstances. The Americans have always been careful to launch their wars in our part of the world. There are many wars during times where the weather is good, like when they captured Kuwait, or when they invaded, they carried out the illegal invasion of Iraq. It was during the cool season. So in the Arabian Peninsula and the Persian Gulf, there are like 6 months of good weather, 5 months of very, very hot and humid weather, and let's say a month or, you know, on the two, between hot and cold, where the weather is transitioning. Right now we're at that transition stage. It'll take gradually, like let's say over a couple of weeks in the coming days, near by the end of by my mid-May, I think the weather is going to rapidly increase in and become very warm and very humid, and so warfare will become much more difficult. So I'm not quite sure the Americans are in a position to, not in a position, but they, I don't think it would be a smart move for them to engage in warfare. Of course, as we speak, so if the Americans carry out an assault on flights over Iranian airspace, that would be the end of the ceasefire. And the Iranians would retaliate. And they, if they retaliate, that means that they will get the opening attacks. They will strike out at targets across the region, and that would be, I think, very beneficial to Iran. So a provocation by the Americans could allow the Iranians to carry out strikes anywhere it likes across the region. And at this moment, when the Americans are preparing their troops and their forces, I think that would be very beneficial to Iran. But in any case, this is increasingly going to become a difficult time for the Americans to wage war because of the weather.
So that's what I had from Professor Mirandi, who's from the University of Tehran in Iran. He's a Mohammed Mirandi, he's a geopolitical analyst and at the University of Tehran, and he was on the platform of Dialogue Works with Nima R. Alkoshield, and this was posted 2 days ago, and let me see what else I've got here. Some of the other things I want, didn't get a chance to talk with Dave, was that if you want to have a International Workers' Day, made a social program on Saturday at the Lucy Parsons Center. is going to have a 5 p.m. cookout and celebrate another year of struggle together, then stay for a program featuring speakers from the front lines of resistance against attacks on workers, immigrants, and communities. And I guess to get the food and child care provided, rain or shine. And the Lucy Parsons Center is at 4100 28th Avenue South. And that it's sponsored by the Freedom Road Socialist Organization of the Twin Cities. So that's on Saturday. And tomorrow it's the 20th Annual International Workers' Day March, 4:30 gathering at Lake in Chicago in Minneapolis. The other thing I wanted to bring about, that with the move towards the draft, registration for the draft automatically, according to the New York Times article, is that there was military experts and historians said the changes had been in the works both during the Biden and Trump administrations, reflecting the unease of planners about the size of the U.S. military. So can't be too cavalier about what's... these people in the Trump administration, they've got big ideas and they're going to push for as much as they possibly can. Now, one of the groups that I follow, been involved with, is a committee opposed to militarism and the draft. They're from San Diego, California. And so their response to this is to stop the U.S. Department of War. And they put out a newsletter called Draft Notices Quarterly. And you can get a copy and a free free spot in Mayday Bookstore, just inside the door. And they'll have a talk about how the coalition that they represent is some 40 different groups. They oppose automatic draft registration, but they go on to say they're seeking to repeal of the Selective Service Law. And so the law, which has been involved for quite a while, they want to get rid of that. And so then the people would have to, for any wars, would they need more people, they'd have to go to Congress to have a resumption of the draft. And they could have registration then, that people, if they believed in the war, they would join up. And that's how the Democratic foreign policy is, that if people think it's a good war, they'll join up. Well, I've got a few things coming up here. Finish off this program. This has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show, and with your host, Don Olson. And I'll be back next week with Dave Gutnick.
This is 10,000 Fresh Voices, a program of Miniculture on KFAI. Did you know that there are more than 300 public library branches in Minnesota? It takes a lot of people power to keep things running smoothly. Many of these libraries are supported by avid book lovers who volunteer as part of their library's friends group. KFAI producer R. May Rivard caught up with a group of retirees in Brainerd dedicated to the support of their local library.
Nearly every library I've been to has a book sale or two during the year. The proceeds from these sales help support all kinds of things at the library. I'm fairly certain these sales are staffed and run by people who love books, and these volunteers are the worker bees behind every successful sale. As a person who loves to read and support my favorite libraries by perusing any sale I find out about, I was curious about how all this worked. Well, I got a peek behind the curtain with the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library as they sorted and sniffed their way through loads of donated books in the receiving area behind the storefront located in the Westgate Mall up in Brainerd. Meet Judy Reardon.
I live in rural Brainerd. I became involved with Friends of the Brainerd Public Library, probably 25 years ago. One of the gals that I worked with volunteered with them, and it sounded interesting. So I began volunteering at their sales.
I had recently retired, and I wanted to do something with my time. I don't like to sew like I used to do. I don't know how to crochet, knit. So I just decided my love is reading books. I got involved, joined a book club with the Friends, and then found out about this book sale.
That's Karen Johnson, the current president of the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library.
My name is Mary Kalinowski, and I live in the Brainerd-Baxter area. I've been up here about 45 years. I'm a retired RN, worked mostly in the clinics, and I've been retired for about 10 years. So working as a Friend of the Brainerd Public Library is one of my volunteer jobs, and the one that I like more than anything else that I do.
This is a group of people that gather every single Tuesday, and we sort through the books. And there are a ton of books that we get that are donated primarily by community members.
My task is when the books come in, we open each box at a time and check the books over. So every book gets handled at least once. We check the cover, make sure it's in good condition. We sniff all our books. We're all good sniffers here. We want our books to smell good. We page through them, fan through them to make sure there's no leftover paperwork in the books that people use for bookmarks. So we occasionally find a letter or store receipts or bookmarks, that kind of thing. We have found money, and several hundred dollars once in cash, and we were able to track the source and give the gentleman his money back. We sort our books and put them in these tubs, and then we move the books from the tubs out into the main part of the store in the correct category.
Judy Reardon, and we would put the books out in preparation for the sale, and then during the sale we would take stacks of books from people and take them up to the checkout table so they wouldn't have to lug all those books around with them. We are located in the Westgate Mall. The mall has been extremely generous to us, giving us space for probably about 10 years. And for the last 5 or so years, we have been located in the same spot, which allowed us to set up as though we were having a book sale. And when we would sort the books, we would just put them out on the tables. And that has really been a lifesaver, saves a lot of time.
Sounds like a workout.
It is. Tuesday is our donation day. So we are here from 9 to 3, and they bring them to the service door of the store that we're located in at the Westgate Mall. About 97% of our books are donated from the public, and the other 3% are ones that the library has cleaned out. We have two pallets end-to-end in our service area in the back. It is not uncommon for those pallets to be empty on a Tuesday morning and be completely filled with boxes of books by the time we leave at 3 o'clock.
Most libraries have a Friends of Fill in the Blank Public Library that really do this. They walk alongside their library and say, how can we help you? What can we do? With that money that we raise, it all goes back into our library for what we call kind of the icing on the cake. we don't determine what we should buy. We look to the librarian, and our librarian looks to the staff and says, what do we need? The Friends group wants to donate. What can we use? So our overall goal is to truly support our library with whatever needs they have, and then also support that love of reading.
The dedication of these gals was impressive. It was more work than I would have ever thought went into sorting books.